Are we ready? Are we ready to go? Yes, we are. That's the signal I'm getting. This is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. You're listening to News Dissector Radio Hour every week at this time on the Progressive Radio Network. If you want to join our conversation, write down this number, 888-874-4888. It's a free number, 888-874-4888, and you can participate in the program tonight. We're going to be talking about, is it really night? I don't know. It's 5 o'clock here, probably lighter where you are. Pilar Levine is in the studio with me. We're talking about some legal cases that are rather scary and rather important today. And one is about a lawyer who's in prison named Lynn Stewart. The other about the Bradley Manning trial with one of the journalists who's been covering it most vigorously. These two events will be the subjects of what we talk about, but we're starting off with a little song about how war, and I would think the war on terror is one of those wars, often collides with truth. Media wars.
Are we going to fix that technical problem?
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News.
Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News. Worked at CNN. To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
General. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom.
Question the prevailing wisdom. Well, how much questioning of the prevailing wisdom are we getting even now in the aftermath of, you know, the continuation of the war in Afghanistan, the so-called aftermath of the war in Iraq, other conflicts around the war, a world drone war, and, of course, the terror war still very much with us. There was an article that I read online and is in my blog at newsdissector.net. Basically, someone, I believe, in Cairo saying, gee, I hope they don't find anybody who's a Muslim in connection with the massacre in Boston. Yeah. Because if they do, here we go again with another massive crackdown. This is happening as the Guantanamo prisoners have actually expanded their strike, their hunger strike, to try to call attention to their conditions. The fact that many of them have been in prison for so many years with no trials, with no adjudication whatsoever, cases that haven't been heard. Their guilt has been assumed, which is nominally a violation, I think, of our Constitution. At any rate, before 9/11, there was an earlier attack on the World Trade Center, and the people who were held responsible for it were also a group of Muslims, and in this case they were arrested in part because they rented a car, a U-Haul truck, in Jersey City, I think, or somewhere over the Hudson, across the Hudson, and they went back to try to get their money back on the deposit, you know, stupidly, and they were arrested. The lawyer for some of them, and for a man that was called the Blind Sheikh, who they served, who is considered terrorist number one. One of the lawyers was Lynn Stewart, who's a progressive American lawyer. And she was involved in that trial. Soon afterwards, after he was convicted, she became targeted. And her legal defense was targeted, and she was accused of collaborating with the terrorist, of being a terrorist herself. Ralph Poynter is on the phone with me. Ralph is Lynn's husband, I believe. Is that right, Ralph?
Yes, sir.
Good. Well, we've established that as a fact. So far, the rest of it has been opinion. And Ralph Poynter has been following this case in far greater detail than I have. But I've just read about it because Lynn is somebody who has been a very strong progressive criminal defender, and she's won many cases here in New York, and she has now been not only incarcerated, but she has cancer and could easily die in prison because of a lack of medical attention and the like. So first thing up here, Ralph, fill us in on the case against Lynn Stewart and what the current status of it is.
Okay, let me make a few corrections.
Thank you. Because I'm sure I made errors, okay?
Oh, no. Just very slight. And it was helped by the media that keeps repeating the falsehoods involved in this case.
Okay.
And the most important issue here is in the World Trade Center number one, the Sheikh was never indicted, never charged with that. What they did say, that some of the members who were charged with it had been to his mosque and heard him preach.
That was it?
That was it.
And that made him the leader of the whole conspiracy?
The Pope had a picture of him in front of the smoking towers every time they had the picture. Superimposed was a picture of the blind sheikh in his sunglasses and turban.
Interesting, because right now, just today, I read an account of the events in Boston where a picture was also superimposed and distorted, a picture of one of the people who were hurt. And in order to make the picture more appeal, have bigger appeal and be less gory, they've changed the picture, photoshopped it, I guess, and now they're getting criticized for doing so. And it seems to happen in all of these crises where, you know, the horror itself is not bad enough. We have to enhance it in some way for public consumption.
Well, this is what I call manipulation of the mass media, the corporate so-called media, because many people have that concept that the blind sheikh was involved in Trade Center 1. He was not.
Okay, now, so what was he accused of?
He was accused of masterminding or being involved in the Landmarks case, where Emad Salem, an Egyptian operative and a worker for this CIA, was to engage people in plots in New York.
So these were the guys that went into the Midtown Tunnel and took pictures,
yes,
supposedly?
Yes, he took pictures, and he had a video camera secretly taking pictures. And what I want people to understand is how bad this was, this whole charge.
So you're saying,
while he was driving down the East Side Drive under the UN, and he said to the man driving, "Let's blow up the UN." And the driver looked down and saw the camera and said, "Are we on TV?" And, listen to me. You can't make this stuff up. And if you go back and look at the case, you'll see this is exactly what happened. And Emad Salem says, "Yes." And he said, "Good," and continued to drive. This is how much of a terrorist he was.
This is the evidence
he
had.
Emad Salem, along with the FBI, CIA, had set up everything. The safe house, got all of the materials, had the car, drove people around, made all of the suggestions. But when he got to the sheikh, and he says, "We want to blow up such and such," and every time the sheikh said no, it would not be a good idea. It is not good for Muslims. Pick a military target. He never agreed with Emad Salem to do anything.
So, I mean, this is a case that, isn't there a lot of cases like this? There seems to be a pattern here, a playbook even, where people are recruited.
Exactly.
And working with people who are working for American agencies get other people into the plot
You have to look at the people to see what a sad joke it is, because these guys didn't know anything. And when you look at that, it makes you want to cry. They had a young man who was now doing life from Newark, New Jersey. And he hung out on the Lower East Side. And Emad Salem said to him, "You're going to be our armorer. Can you get a gun?" And he says, "I can get all the guns you want." Guess what he brought him? He brought him back a rusty rifle that did not work. Now, think of this.
If he had only gone to the NRA, Ralph, I'm sure they could have helped him get better weapons, right?
I mean, an inside joke, and I hope everybody got it.
Okay.
Here's a young man in Newark, New Jersey, hanging on the Lower East Side, who couldn't even buy a weapon. And guess what Emot did? He paid him $1,500 for this rusty rifle that did not fire. This is the caliber of people he involved. Now, if you were sitting on a jury and you would say, gee, I know Alphabet City, I know Newark, New Jersey, I could walk down there myself today and buy a gun. He could not buy a gun, but he's doing life in prison for being a part of
a plot.
All right,
so now we haven't gotten to Lynn yet, but let's start with you for a moment.
Yes.
Tell us who you are. You know, what's your background in all of this? You're not a lawyer.
No.
this must have been, you know, kind of almost an Alice in Wonderland shock for you to get.
Well, it was a shock for both of us because when we met, we were teachers in Harlem. PS 175 on 135th and Lenox Avenue. And we were the people, our organization was the first to put out grade levels. You know, we say they're not working on grade level. This class is not doing well. This school is not doing well. Well, before we came on the scene, it was illegal and nobody did it.
Nobody kept track.
And when we did it, I signed my name and I was fired instantly. Then we fought, and I did it the following year. I sent it to every New York newspaper. And now it is common knowledge, but I'm still fired. And there were you couldn't even become a principal in New York City if you were black. How are you going to try to educate kids and say you can't even aspire to be a principal? And it goes further. You could not aspire to be a stationary engineer in the New York City public schools, which is ridiculous. You couldn't aspire to be a plumber.
Okay, but Ralph, let's get this. We're focusing on the law here. You weren't a lawyer, is the point.
I was an activist.
And you were then introduced to this world of litigation, of trials, of criminal defense, and all the rest of it, which, of course, is the heart of our system. It's a fairness in our court system is
supposedly the essence of
the system. And the New York Times has just been running a series on the courts in the Bronx. Have you read this, Pilar? Have you seen any of these articles?
Oh, yeah, actually, I have.
These articles about how long it takes to get a trial and how screwed up it is and how they lose documents and how, you know, these lawyers are making a ton of money on, you know, just showing up and then delaying the trial, you know, further. And some of these trials have been delayed for years up there.
The delays help their clients.
It's a travesty, though. The whole legal system is
like... Well, as Lynn Stewart says it best when she says, with all of its warts and bumps, she likes the idea of the American system where... Members or your peers go to court and decide on your behalf. But she said it is so warped and twisted by race hatred, by money concerns, that it doesn't work. But she says it is a good idea having juries and trials and a combative type of legal system.
Ralph, you know, the famous... American comedian Lenny Bruce put it this way. He said, "In the halls of justice," he said, "the only justice is in the halls." Okay, I mean, this was his view. So now comes Lynn, this woman that you met as a teacher.
Was asked by Ramsey Clark, ex-Attorney General of the United States. I was there when he called her to his office. And after the phone call, she said, I wonder what he wants with me. And she said, would you come with me when I go to visit Ramsey Clark? And I said, of course. We went to the office, and Ramsey Clark stated in so many words, you have been a great asset to black people, to poor people, to the radical movement, now become an asset to your government. Because Ramsey Clark was a part of the government that felt that the government was doing it wrong, and his exact words were, a day will come where America will have no allies in the Middle East. And he says, we have an opportunity to be an ally of somebody in the Middle East, If we show that we can get one of their revered scholars, a top-notch lawyer, to defend them.
To have a fair trial, basically.
Have a fair trial.
I mean, you know, in Alice in Wonderland, it says, you know, first the sentence and then the trial. Okay.
And the trial.
So well, in this case, we want the trial before the sentence, I would think, you know.
They wouldn't want to have that appearance that America was doing that to a revered scholar who was Hafiz, who memorized the Quran at 14, and he was well respected. Saudi Arabia asked him to go there and retire, but they wanted a certain type of religion, which the Sheikh did not agree.
All right, so without getting into the Sheikh too much, but I want to get into Lynn. Lynn Stewart agrees to represent this man, okay? Agrees to try to defend him, give him his right of a fair trial. What happens then?
Because Judge Mukasey, who turned out to be later became Attorney General of the United States, who said that torture was legal and okay, made rulings, and for the first time I saw Lynn cry in court, because they charged the Sheikh not with doing anything, but what they charged him with was not refusal, but neglecting to turn in his a supporter who was suggesting these things. And it's just like going to a priest and saying, I'm going to murder somebody, and the priest says no, and then the priest doesn't go to the police and say, you know, this guy said he was going to murder somebody. I told him not to do it. He didn't do it, but I'm telling you. Well, a priest's job is not to do that. Neither is a sheikh's job. And when Lynn had hired an expert, I believe from Princeton University, on Islamic studies to come in and explain the role of a sheikh, like that of a priest, so that this would go away, Judge Mukasey said it would only confuse the jury and would not allow that information to be introduced to the jury.
So in other words, Lynn is trying to give this man a fair trial by explaining who he is, what he stands for, what he did, what he didn't do, whatever. Okay,
yes.
whether or not, that's true or not, I don't know. I wasn't
that
there.
That is true. Take it to the bank. Ralph Pointer said it.
Okay, I'll take it to the bank for now.
Goes to the
Pilar, will you take it to the bank?
I don't trust any of these banks. I'll take it home, put it under my mattress.
He doesn't trust the banks, Ralph. Okay, but all right.
It's under my mattress, Ralph.
All right, so here's Lynn in this court. With a judge basically turning down all of her motions to try to do our job, which is to defend this guy, right?
Right.
So then what happens? How does she go from being...
Then he's found guilty.
Right,
and
okay.
Then Lynn assisted Abdin Jabara and Ramsey Clark in the appeals. And after all of the appeals were gone, Lynn assisted Ramsey Clark and Abdin Jabara. In 2 years, she saw the Sheikh three times.
Okay.
Every conversation was recorded by the government.
Right, okay.
If they had found anything that was like passing a message, you would have heard it. What they did find is Lynn made a public statement of the Sheikh's through Reuters to say that the Sheikh himself had withdrawn his support for the unilateral ceasefire. That meant in the newspapers, in the media, diplomatically against Hosni Mubarak, the dictator of 28 years.
Right, and of course, in those years, of course, we were supporting Mubarak, okay? The people of
the U.S. government.
The U.S. government and many Americans, because they didn't even know there was an opposition to Mubarak.
There was no opposition.
They didn't know about the human rights abuses in Egypt. They didn't know any of this. It wasn't being covered. The United States was funding the Mubarak dictatorship. Let's remember that. So here we go. Here's a guy. He's against Mubarak. Okay. I mean, today being against Mubarak, he's one of millions. Then there were very few with the guts to stand up against Mubarak.
Because when you stood up against Mubarak, you could go to jail. You could be killed. There were no opposition to Mubarak. Nobody ran in an election against Mubarak.
So what happens to Lynn? Like, here's Lynn. You know, I mean, she's as far as I know, I mean, I've met her a few times. She doesn't look like a terrorist to me. I mean, she looks like a lawyer, okay?
Well, if she says, I'm a grandmother from Brooklyn, but that's not why they put me in jail. And that morning, when they came down, and I was in the front door stopping the FBI from coming in the house. And, you know, like, they started in a door, and it was a very small door, and I was in the doorway. So I started wrestling with one of the agents. And, you know, I tell him, hey, you can't come in. I don't see a warrant. I don't see a badge. I don't see anything. And Lynn was coming down the stairs, and she walked to the door, and she says, Ralph, don't make it worse. We'll have you out by noontime. And when she stepped to the door to say that, the agent standing at the bottom of the stairs says, hey, we didn't come for him. We came for you.
You thought they were there for you. And well, here comes Lynn, the lawyer.
That's right. She says, Ralph gets arrested going to a PTA meeting. You know, I'm always getting arrested. She was shocked. And she says, as a lawyer, she knew to keep her mouth shut. And they took her down. She says, not like that other woman, that other Stewart, Martha Stewart. They told her when to show up. She showed up with her lawyer under an umbrella. They handcuffed Lynn and took her down because it was a show. Ashcroft had just announced from Ground Zero that they have arrested the grandmother. He went on David Letterman to talk about it. And what is the grandmother being arrested for? It's a public press release. Period. There were no secret messages, as the media keeps saying.
So in other words, she put out a press release, and she was then charged with actually working with the blind sheikh.
That's right.
In some sort of terrorist cabal.
And let me add to this. Other lawyers before put out messages that the sheikh had sent. Ramsey Clark, Abdin Jabbar, other lawyers on other terrorist cases put out messages before Lynn, and continued after Lynn, but the government, and the people don't understand, the government holds the right to make selective prosecution. That is, if we stand side by side, I spit on the street and you spit on the street, they have no obligation to treat us both the same.
Right.
They
so just talking to you, Ralph, on what? The Progressive Radio Network, I can end up with a vacation somewhere upstate. It seems like, you know, under the way laws are written and rewritten. But so what's happened to Lynn now? What's her status? I mean, she wasn't well.
She got a 28-month sentence from Judge Codal. And the Second Circuit thought it wasn't correct. So they wrote a note saying, Lynn Stewart, this is the Second Circuit. Lynn Stewart continues to travel around the country to law schools and universities, corrupting our youth. Therefore, the judge should resentence her. Can you imagine?
She was already sentenced. What was her first sentence?
Her first sentence was 28 months.
And then?
And then when the Second Circuit said she showed no remorse, and Lynn says, remorse, I'm protecting the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech.
And so what was her second sentence?
The second sentence was 120 months.
So
now she is doing 10 years, and she has done 3.5 years so far. And the week that she was, when the Second Circuit said she must go to jail immediately, she was scheduled for an operation, an internal operation. Well, after she went to jail, it took her 18 months to get that operation. And due to the time lapse, the doctor in the Fort Worth hospital who did it said it was the worst he had ever seen because they took so long to get her to a hospital to get her operation. And Lynn says this is the problem with the so-called healthcare in the hospital in federal prison cannot be done because the prison is between the doctors and the hospital, and it takes months.
Is her life at risk now, Ralph?
What?
Is her life at risk?
Her life is at risk. And you see, when I said to people, don't you see they're looking to kill her? They look at me as if I was telling a Grimm's fairy tale. Until the warden at Carswell wrote a letter saying, and you can go to Lynn's website saying it, when Lynn had applied for compassionate release, to get her health taken care of. They said she has a life expectancy of 2 to 3 years. And when it gets down to 8 months, then we will talk about possible release.
How thoughtful and how compassionate. You know, Ralph, this must be a nightmare for you every single day dealing with this.
Well, I can only give Lynn Stewart's answer. And I went to see Lynn Stewart just last week. And she's thinner. She has no hair because she, after 4 months of discovering the cancer that was moving, she got chemotherapy. And, of course, it takes your hair out, and it does other things to you. But as Lynn, in her own words, was, so many people have sacrificed so much to bring America even to the point that it is now. And she says, I have enjoyed the skin privilege of racist, imperialist America. So how can I complain about trying to make it better?
Well, excuse me, Ralph. I think the rest of us can do some complaining here. And
well,
certainly pass your story on. This program will be on a podcast on the archives of PRN tomorrow. Please share it with your friends and listen to this account.
I certainly will.
And I'm talking now to the audience, not just to you.
What
is the website? What is the website for Lynn Stewart where people can get the dirty details of this?
Lynn Stewart, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, .org. Very simple. And I tell people, you will be educated and entertained while you read Lynn Stewart's
well,
website.
Thank you, Ralph, for coming on. I had hoped to have you in the studio. We were having some trouble kind of agreeing on what day it was, but we did it. We pulled it. We pulled
and
it.
Thank you again. Lynn, thank you.
We
thank
pulled
you,
it off, and you did a fantastic job of explaining this case. You have to read these details. You have to read this story about the U.S. government versus Lynn Stewart and put it in the context of this war on of era, not of terror.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
is.
And
on.
I would ask everybody to please, when you get on that website, sign on to her petition to free Lynn Stewart.
Thank you, Ralph. We have to leave now. We're running out of time, so we will try to follow up if there are new details. Let us know about them, Ralph Poynter. You are yourself heroic in the way you've been fighting to get the truth out. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back in a few minutes with the story of what's happening with Bradley Manning.
Whoa,
another trial.
And Lynn cries out for support.
Another trial that we really need to know about. Stay with us.
Thank you.
And Media Wars is coming up next. Okay. Let's say goodbye to Matt, who's been with PRN for a long time and has done a great job here. Jessel at the controls right now. Pilar Levine in the studio with me, your news dissector, Danny Schechter, on the weekly News Dissector Radio Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. The number to call, 888-874-488. This next segment continues our theme of In the Halls of Justice, the only justice is in the halls, as we revisit the Bradley Manning trial with Kevin Gostola. Is that how you pronounce your last name? I'm sorry if I get it wrong.
That's correct.
Hey, I got it on the first crack. Pretty good. Of Fire Dog Lake, who has been writing, covering this trial in a way that really is one of a number of heroic journalists who are basically have every obstacle put in their path to tell the story of Bradley Manning. Now, one of the most recent issues was that Bradley Manning actually testified in court about his motivations for releasing all of those secret documents to WikiLeaks and others, and the collateral murder video, which showed war crimes in Iraq, and that although he was actually very straight up, you know, pro-military soldier, he couldn't take what was going on, and he felt he had to share it with the public. So before we start, Kevin, let's listen to Bradley Manning himself in a audio that was actually allowed in the court, where he's allowed to speak, and then the judges there really got freaked out and uptight about the fact that this had gotten out of court and into the public domain. Bradley Manning, everybody, here he is.
All rise.
The video just crashed. We'll come back to it in a minute. Kevin, set the scene for us. Bradley Manning finally given a chance after how many months to address the court on why, you know, he did some of what they're accusing him of doing. Tell us where things stand in this trial right now, and then we'll get back in a little into your own role in all of this.
Yeah, so Bradley was arrested and detained in the end of May in 2010. So if we think of that period between that time to February 28th, you've basically got over 2 years there where we haven't heard from Bradley Manning himself why he would have engaged in the disclosure of information to WikiLeaks. And, you know, to set the scene, this clip that you could be playing, if it relates to the collateral murder video, is quite profound to hear him talk about it. I think in the clip, you will hear him talk about how he viewed this video as war porn. And what I've found in covering this is that this was a video that was shown to all soldiers in the intelligence facility where he was working at. He was based at Forward Operating Base Hammer in Baghdad. He worked as a low-level intelligence analyst, helping the military with things like security around the Iraq elections. And this video was a part of discussion. They actually had a discussion about the rules of engagement, and Bradley decided to go do some research, and he decided to figure out why the video was not being given to Reuters, because, of course, for those who may be aware, the video shows two Reuters employees being gunned down, yet they submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to U.S. Central Command, and U.S. Central Command was not responsive, was not giving them a copy of the video so they could see what had happened to their employees. So
just a little of the backstory, Kevin, a little of the backstory, you know, during the invasion of Iraq, there was an incident at the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad where an American soldier on a tank opened fire on a room in the hotel, and a number of reporters were killed and hurt, including a Reuters reporter. And it was Reuters alone among the many American news organizations, as documented in my film, WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, who protested the treatment of their journalist by the United States. And, of course, later, Jose Cuso's family, he's a Spanish journalist, also protested about what happened there. But most of the media, as my film shows and in my view, you know, have been extremely complicit, not very critical, and not really very aggressive in getting the truth to the American people. And that seems to be what's happening in the Bradley Manning trial as well. Agree, disagree? How do you feel about it?
Oh, I think that's agreeable. A lot of what is said in the courtroom is taken at face value. There's very few journalists that have taken the statements in court and gone on to, after they put it out in news reports, go on and do additional analysis to see whether what was said is reasonable or bogus, to give people an idea of just how ridiculous some of the theories that they're throwing at Bradley Manning happen to be.
Well, you know, I've done an interview with one of your colleagues, Alexa O'Brien, who also was on a panel with you and others at a meeting at the Judson Church, I guess a week ago, talking about the Bradley Manning case. And, you know, Alexa described all the interference, the difficulties that journalists have, and even getting a record of the trial, any of the documents of the trial have been denied to the journalists and to the public. And now with the kind of dissemination of a statement by Bradley Manning, I'm going to try to hear it again. You know, the judge has gone ballistic against the journalists. I'd like to hear about what's happened in the last week, but let's see if we can't pick up that video where we left off.
Sessions called maybe I wrote the statement in confinement, so I'll start now. Following facts are provided in support of the province inquiry for my court martial, United States versus PFC Bradley E. Mann. Personal facts. I am a 25-year-old private first class in the United States Army. My primary military occupational specialty, or PMOS, is 35 Foxtrot, intelligence analyst. I entered active duty status on 2 October 2007. I enlisted with the hope of obtaining both real-world experience and earning benefits under the GI Bill for college opportunities. My recruiter informed me that I should select an MOS that complemented my interests outside the military. In response, I told him that I was interested in geopolitical matters and information technology. He suggested I consider becoming an intelligence analyst.
It's a little difficult to understand. The audio's a little rough here, but it is online. If you go to Google audio of Bradley Manning in court, you can hear this, and you really should hear it, because it's a case of a young man, 25 years old, describing why he felt compelled to make this available publicly. And journalists like Kevin and Alexa and some of their colleagues have been working very hard to get this information out. If you go to mediachannel.org, we still have a interview with Alexa up, an interview that I did that you might find of interest. What's your take on this, Polar?
Yeah, well, I'd like to know if it's customary for military trials to be hidden from public view. Is this a normal thing, that journalists are not allowed to cover it?
Well, I think that we need to clarify the way we discuss the lack of access, because everyone that I know at this point who has tried to get a credential to go cover has been given one by the military. So you're able to be in the media center to see the feed. So then the other thing we should talk about is maybe the conditions that people have to experience when they're covering the proceedings, and then also it's not exactly the most sexy of issues to discuss, but the fact that we don't have court records given to us when we are there, and that makes it especially burdensome in some instances.
So are you saying that you're not actually present when the hearing's taking place?
Oh, no, I'm there.
You are.
Hearing when
okay.
It's taking place.
But you don't have access to the records.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so typically if you were in a federal courtroom, you would, the day of, be able to see the judge's ruling online, or you might be able to read a transcript in the cases of, like, I'll just take the Guantanamo Military Commission's proceedings with the 9/11 terror suspects. So that's got a level of transparency that they won't even offer in military court-martials in general. So Bradley Manning is not exclusive. However, given the high publicity that has been given to his case, you know, the military has not responded to this and decided to grant it an additional level of transparency, even though there's been an outcry. I guess what would also be good to discuss is there was an incident last week with the public affairs officer, and I wrote about this online, and I think this would be something that you'd be interested in, Danny, because it goes to how journalists are treated, and we were basically told in the room that because of the leak, that we needed to police ourselves. And we were told that if there is another violation, quote, everyone feels the pain, not just certain individuals, end quote. So this is the reaction of the military. And they sort of, the officer was even sort of threatening to take away the media center we've been using and stick us in the courtroom if another leak happened to occur of the audio. So you're sort of treating press freedom as this privilege that the military is giving us. And the big consequence there, if we ended up in the courtroom, would be that we would not be able to use our computers. And so far, that's been one of the few things that we have going for us that doesn't make it just, you know, 99% grueling when we are there to bring people this story.
Are there any laws on the books in this country that about transparency?
I'd like you to withdraw that question, please, or face the consequences.
Oh, come on, Judge. Seriously, though, I mean, are there, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, but aren't there laws about stuff like this, or does the military, exists under, as a part of the government in this country, right? Isn't that part of the deal? Do you know, Kevin, about...
So I know because, you know, as a plaintiff, I was pushing this Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit that the military appeals court just ruled on, and you know, we were asking for access to the records, and the military appeals court just said yesterday, this was reported widely, that they are not going to grant the Center for Constitutional Rights the ability to challenge the secrecy in the proceedings. So we're not going to be given these access to records during Bradley Manning's trial.
But in the United States of America, of which the military is a part,
is he naive, Kevin, or what? Go ahead.
Yeah. No. I mean, you know, is there a law that covers military trials?
That's what I was getting to. So in case law, yes, they are supposed to give us. Transparency or public access is probably the better way to phrase it, but that's left up entirely to the discretion of the military. So they get to determine what public access happens to be. So that can be, you know, it can be what you and I would consider public access, or it could be, you know, a more Orwellian sort of interpretation
Hey,
of
Kevin,
public access.
Kevin, if, with the access that you have, if you had, say, stenographic skills, right, and you were able to just write down everything that's being said as it's being said, you would have access to the record. Isn't that true? I mean, you're not allowed to record the proceedings, but you're allowed to take notes, right?
Absolutely.
So if you brought a stenographer with you?
Well, I wouldn't bring one because we have Alexa O'Brien, and she's been doing the role of sort of the public stenographer that she shouldn't have to do. But the government has, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the government actually cited her as an excuse for why they didn't have to provide access to records.
Mm-hmm. And Alexa O'Brien has been making these transcripts and posting them on her website, Alexa O'Brien. .com, everybody, B-R-I-E-N, .com. And, you know, it's an incredible, the two of them have done an amazing job of trying as best they can to get this story out. But use the word before, Orwellian. In what way is this Orwellian?
Well, I just would say that it makes absolutely no sense that they wouldn't apply the First Amendment and give us the records so that we all could see them. So right now they are claiming to have an openness in a trial where only a limited number of people can attend. You know, only the 30 to 50 people who regularly go or can get in. I mean, I should mention for our listeners that the public gallery is not that big. And whether the military would grant an additional, you know, would open a larger room so that people could be there and there could be maybe 50 to 100 more people. You know, right now the public gallery would fit about 20 to 25 people, I would think. So
smaller than an off-Broadway theater. It seems to me, Kevin, that this must be very frustrating, I have to say. It's very frustrating. Alexa has told me about other journalists from other news organizations, I guess, falling asleep in the courtroom because it's just impossible to listen to all of this. You know, we hear about drones, but in a sense, lawyers droning on. And you're, you know, doing a very, to me, a very heroic thing in being a witness for America at this trial, for the right of Americans to know what's actually happening here. Do you feel like he's being given a fair trial?
I think that there are many questions about that. The problem is the problem is the court-martial system itself, the military justice system itself. I mean, I walked in there. This is my first military justice proceeding that I've ever covered, and I immediately realized that there's a critical flaw here because you've got a civilian lawyer representing Bradley Manning named David Coombs who's arguing against the U.S. military that's trying to put this young man in prison for life for supposedly, they argue, aiding terrorists. And the military is going to make their case to a military judge, okay? It doesn't take much to figure out that that's pretty flawed and problematic. And so now a civilian lawyer is going to make an argument to a military judge that his soldier who violated a code that I think is much more significant in the military, that the code of secrecy, the code of silence. I mean, I think soldiers are going to be subjected to far more punishment for doing what Bradley Manning did than they ever would be for killing innocent civilians.
Do you think that's why they're coming down so heavily on Bradley Manning? Because they want to make an example of him? They want to prevent any other soldiers from doing what he did, disseminating information that those soldiers believe violates their conscience or violates our right to know?
I think so. I think that I would quickly point out that yesterday there's a story reported by another colleague of mine, Nathan Fuller, of the Bradley Manning Support Network, who's been doing some good reporting for that group. And he points out that they just sentenced a 25-year-old military policeman to 16 years in prison for trying to sell information to someone who was working for Russia, allegedly, and was seeking to profit off of this classified information, and he got 16 years. So that is way less than what they're trying to put Bradley Manning away for.
So what is your sense of Bradley Manning as a person? You've sat there and watched him and heard his testimony, and one of the things that strikes me is that Bradley Manning is no radical firebrand when it comes to the military. He's not sort of denouncing imperialism in the courthouse. He's actually very respectful of military procedure, isn't he?
That's correct. I think he very much believes in the institution of the military, and perhaps that's where he decided ultimately to go ahead and expose information, because he believed in the rules, and he thought he believed that the military could be doing something humanely in Iraq, and that could be a flawed way of thinking on his part, and you dispute that. But I think he believes that the military should have been doing something good for Iraq, and he clearly saw that it was not. And so he decided to take action, as a lot of whistleblowers have done before when they see that the institutions they work for are in complete error.
I think Manning's only error was to not understand that, unlike during the Vietnam War, that when Ellsberg gave up files to the media, that America was truly terrified by 9/11, and I don't think people in this country are aware. We have all the platitudes about American freedom never ended. We just got up and no. This country was absolutely terrified. We got rid of habeas corpus. We have gone absolutely berserk. And this is not, the way things used to be, when you could release something like that and the courts at least would understand it.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg has been a big supporter of Bradley
sure.
Manning, and sees himself in Bradley Manning in many ways as a whistleblower. But I think, the challenge in a way, even as we get it, we'll go review the details and the legal arguments, is what would we do? What would you do? And I'm talking now to the listener who might be listening right now. What would you do if you were in this situation? You're in the military, you're in Iraq, you may not want to be there, but you are following orders, and you find out and see that there's this collateral, kind of murder video, basically, and you see these helicopter pilots you know, having fun shooting down people, including children, in the streets. Would you have the courage that he had? Would you speak out about it? Would you try to disseminate it? I mean, this is a challenge not just to the military. It's not just a challenge to American law. It's also a challenge to all of us as citizens about whether or not we would have the guts to stand up for what we believe in if we were ever in a situation like this. Would we try to tell the truth, or would we just go about doing our jobs and look the other way? I mean, isn't that part of the challenge here? Isn't that one of the reasons you're working on this story so diligently, Kevin?
Yeah, I think so. In addition to the fact that I've admitted that I benefited as a journalist because of what Bradley Manning did, I did incredible, extensive reporting on the U.S. State Embassy cables when they came out. I was doing numbers of stories from December 2010 through on to the middle of the next year. And those were some stories that I thought were pretty successful with people who were reading them. They shared them widely. And I felt like it was just natural that I would go on and give this a lot of coverage because I guess you could call Bradley Manning a sort of a source because, you know, I was using the material he put out for my purposes, and it improved my status.
Well, not just for you, but also for your readers and hopefully for the American people who are being denied access to a lot of the information, the context, the background to this important case. Thank you for your work, Kevin. Thanks to Alexa, to Mr. Fuller, to all of you who are trying so hard to get the word out on all of this. This podcast, this program will be on a podcast on PRN.FM in the archives tomorrow. I'm going to be posting it in my blog at newsdissector.net tomorrow online. We are also covering this case on themediachannel.org, which I'm editing. So there is an effort here to support the work that you guys have been doing. And, I, for one, identify very much with the work that you're doing. I don't know if I myself would have the discipline to go down, schlep down to Virginia and be bullied around to actually cover this trial. But you're doing it, and I wanted to have you on and tell you how much we appreciate that, Kevin, and the work of your colleagues. This is an important case. It's an important story. And unfortunately, it's very much an ongoing story. It's an ongoing story that we really need to relate to and deal with. There's a film opening at the Cinema Village dealing with journalists, the journalists at Angola Prison who've tried to get the word out. We're going to be going out with a kind of an enhanced little song that Polarity One, Polar Levine did about Bob. What does it tell us?
Bob Smith of the FBI. Actually, this is about you.
Yeah,
this
Bob Smith of the FBI who invaded my house one day.
Gave me an old cassette from 1973 of when the FBI showed up at his doorstep, and I cut it up, and here it is.
What's happening here? What's happening here? All right, what's your name? Show us your identification. What's happening here? Show us your identification.